From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1970 in a national survey by the Kinsey Institute. The survey asked respondents to either agree or disagree with various statements, and here was one of them. Quote, homosexuals are dangerous as teachers or youth leaders because they try to get sexually involved with children, and homosexuals try to play sexually with children if they cannot get an adult partner. 70% of Americans agreed with that. A staggering majority of Americans believe that gay people would target and abuse children. Before we go any further, you should know that that is not true. Research shows that child abuse is not committed disproportionately by gay people, but that didn't stop the devastating stereotype. Slowly, America's views of gay people changed over the years, but that slur has been out there, and last week it resurfaced in a sad and very public way. The actor Anthony Rapp gave an interview to BuzzFeed, saying that when he was 14 years old, the actor Kevin Spacey, then 26, sexually assaulted him in a private party. The next day, Spacey released a statement saying that if this happened, he was probably intoxicated when it happened, and Spacey added that he is a gay man, the first public coming out in his career. Spacey's sexuality had been the subject of tabloid rumors for a long time, but why come out now? Why come out in this context, while all but confirming the allegation that he preyed on a child? Our guest this hour will help us understand the reality versus the stereotypes while discussing why this issue continues to resurface in 2017. In studio, we have Rowan Collins, who is Education and Communications Coordinator for the LGBTQ Academy at the Out Alliance. Rowan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Kevin Coffey is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Michael Lecker is Director of LGBTQ Health and Inclusiveness at Trillium Health. Michael, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
I'll start with you, Michael. We'll just go around the table and ask you, when you saw Kevin Spacey, you know what I should do? Let me read Kevin Spacey's entire statement in case you somehow missed that, because if you, I want you to know exactly what we're talking about. Kevin Spacey came out after the BuzzFeed story with Anthony Rapp and put this statement out. Quote, I have a lot of respect and admiration for Anthony Rapp as an actor. I'm beyond horrified to hear his story. I honestly do not remember the encounter. It would have been over 30 years ago. But if I did behave then, as he describes, I owe him the sincerest apology for what would have been deeply inappropriate, drunken behavior. And I am sorry for the feelings he describes having carried with him all these years. This story has encouraged me to address other things about my life. I know that there are stories out there about me, and that some have been fueled by the fact that I have been so protective of my privacy. As those closest to me know, in my life I have had relationships with both men and women. I have loved and had romantic encounters with men throughout my life, and I choose now to live as a gay man. I want to deal with this honestly and openly, and that starts with examining my own behavior. End quote from Kevin Spacey. Michael, I'll start with you. Thoughts on the statement and its possible impact?
Yeah, the statement didn't really shock me. I think it's not really Kevin's statement. It's the statement of our culture. This is something that he might not culturally have been consciously thinking about, like I am linking these two, but, you know, within our cultural environment, it's just one that, you know, isn't people are actively talking about, but more of a specter of this identity, something that's been haunted by this identity because the anti-gay rights movement in the 1970s that tried to link these two separate phenomena.
Okay. Rowan, thoughts on that?
I mean, I have to agree with Michael. The equation of, you know, sexual misconduct, especially with minors, and non-consensual behavior, linking that to the identity of being gay or within the LGBT community in general, is really harmful and something that has been so pervasive over the decades, and something that, while we see has gone away to a certain extent, this reignites this kind of link and gives fuel to a fire that doesn't need to be stoked.
Mm. Okay. Kevin?
I think the timing was unfortunate that I think the two are not the same. And I think by coming out when he was responding to the allegation was really inappropriate in many ways, because it linked the two, which they're not.
Does this potentially do more damage to the cause of trying to bury this untrue stereotype or rumor once and for all?
I think it's hurt that. And I think there are people who would latch on to this. I don't think it's much different than what happens in the straight world. But I think there are people who are anti-gay, I think, who will latch on to it.
Yeah, so just in recent years, I remember 2006, the writer David Rakoff was composing a piece on log cabin Republicans, and that essay that he wrote ended up in his book that came out in 2006, Don't Get Too Comfortable. He interviewed Robert Knight of the Culture and Family Institute. Knight has had influence in conservative circles and has been deeply opposed to the inclusion of gay people in the Republican Party because he said he didn't trust their agenda. Knight accused gay Republicans of trying to harness government power to force affirmation of, quote, destructive behavior. And Knight went on to say that gay people advocate pedophilia. Rakoff wrote that Knight truly believed there was a gay agenda and that preying on children was high on the list. That's 2006. As late as 2010, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins was quoted citing the link between, as he saw it, homosexuality and pedophilia as a reason not to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And of course, in Russia, protecting children was the stated purpose of the 2013 law banning gay propaganda. So you don't have to go back to, what was the 1977 campaign, the Protect Our Children? Save Our Children. You don't have to go back that far. You know, these are conservative leaders in various circles in this country in recent years still citing this stuff here. So, Rowan, what does that say to us that this is still invoked as often as it is?
I think there's always an unfortunate kind of resonance, a lingering of things that have been brought up in previous decades that if they aren't loudly, publicly disclaimed and told to be untrue, that folks really do hang on. They're like, well, you know, you can say that this one study disproves this, but my own emotional feeling is that this must be true. And there's always that fight of, you know, people's feelings and emotions versus, you know, fact and what we assume to be objective truth, that, you know, you can bring as many facts to the discussion as you want to, but if someone really deeply feels that this is how someone is going to be acting, it's really hard to convince them otherwise. And so I think that often that's what's been the issue, is that, you know, it's been like, well, these studies and these myths versus facts and research findings, and, you know, we all actually brought in pieces of paper with, like, here's the data on this that says this is not true. But decades and decades of saying this is not true has clearly not done as much as we need it to, because all it takes, right, is one person to say, to help equate those two things, and, you know, we're right back where we started.
Sure, and if you all have data, that's great, because in a second I'll ask you just to kind of share, because our listeners, you know, love to grab onto research. Not that I think most of our listeners have any issue with the contention that there is no pernicious or regular issue with gay men and pedophilia outside of any normal populational statistic. But here's the issue with Kevin Spacey, Rowan. Kevin Spacey, and I agree with Michael, I don't even think he was attempting to link it. I think he probably was attempting to provide himself a little bit of cover. Mm-hmm. But in so doing, and I say cover, what I mean is a little bit of a distraction, knowing that the headline will be, oh, Kevin Spacey finally comes out. And for a little while, that happened at Reuters and a few other places. But when that happens, if Kevin Spacey is essentially kind of admitting that he might have assaulted a child and also saying, by the way, I'm gay. Mm-hmm. Well, there are gay people who assault children, just as there are straight people who assault children, just as there are planes that crash. You know, planes really don't crash very often. It's pretty safe to fly. But if you know someone was on a plane crash, you could say, well, don't tell me planes don't crash. Well, yes, planes crash. The problem is when you've got a high-profile case like this, my concern is people grab it and go, oh, well, I had heard for years that it wasn't an issue. What's going on here? Because Americans aren't very good at math. What do you think, Rowan?
No, I think I agree. And there's so much involved in kind of that link between kind of I mean, whether we want to take that blanket term of pedophilia just to describe anyone who's under the age of consent, or, you know, and then add on, you know, non-consensual, like, sexual abuse and all the aspects that come with that, and then link it into orientation. I mean, so much of the work that's been done around pedophilia and kind of attraction to underage individuals is that complete distinction between basically a lack of a mature sexual orientation. So people who are kind of repeatedly attracted to younger people have very often not had any sort of attraction to mature adults or have regressed in some way. And so that link needs to be undone as well, because what we're equating is two very different things. But that hasn't been undone yet. And so we add all these extra pieces in and it just gets too complicated.
And so in a second, I'll ask our guests to kind of go ahead and share some of the research that is out there on this. And producer Megan Mack grabbed some as well. There's a good amount of research out there. But before we do that, I'll tell our listeners, if you want to call the program, I already have a couple of emails from listeners. We will share some of your emails if you want to. And I would say, you know, look, if you want to discuss stereotypes either you dealt with or that you've heard about, or ways that we can get past this, because we still have to do much, much better. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. No, it's not 1970 with 70% of respondents to a national survey saying they're worried that homosexuals could be dangerous as teachers because they prey on children. I mean, that's not believed at that rate anymore. But, you know, look at other polls that have come out over the years. The research indicates, you know, that still, what was the number? Let's see here. In 1977, 27% of Americans in a Gallup poll thought that gay people should be allowed to be elementary school teachers. 54% said they should be allowed in 2005. But think about that. 54% in 2005 of Americans said, sure, gay people should be allowed to be elementary school teachers. Not 100%, not 94%, 54%. Now, that's 12 years ago. I haven't seen the latest of the latest on that. But whatever it is, it's not, I mean, I think it's not subjective or editorializing too much to say it's not high enough, because there's still a lot of misunderstanding out there. So let me go around the table before we take some more of your feedback. And Michael, I'll start with you. What is the what does the research tell us about these issues?
So actually, I don't have a lot of research in front of me, but I do want to say about that 54%.
Yeah.
I think that's people are wanting to believe, especially in this cultural climate, that they are accepting. But I think what this might reveal is that while people want to be accepting and think that they know the facts and know the facts, what this movement does and this linkage does is it preys off people's fears, and their emotions can kind of override that knowledge that they have. So while they may be like, yes, I know that LGBTQ people are not going to be sexual predators, that feeling of especially going after children, this population who are especially vulnerable, can trigger old stereotypes to pop back up, old prejudices that we didn't even know we had to pop back up. I've had friends with incredibly accepting parents that come out, and then there's a moment of hesitation about, what about your siblings? Like, the fact that, do I have to protect them? And, you know, I think they know that they don't, but there's that fear that lurks, and that's that cultural legacy, that cultural baggage that, you know, 100 years ongoing with it, we still can't unpack fully.
Okay. Rowan, anything you want to share in terms of data or what we should know about the reality of these issues?
Sure. I mean, there's been kind of a dearth of some of these studies in recent years because so much was done in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that was pretty hard to say, no, this isn't empirically sound, and there's no way to, you know, redo the study. And so there hasn't actually been a ton done in the last 20-something years. But, I mean, they found multiple studies, especially out of a couple of Department of Corrections and Sheriff's Office, along with the UCLA Medical Center has done a few back in the 90s that found that, you know, when they were looking at rates of kind of sexual predators and child molesters within the male population, they found that anywhere between 90 to 98% identified as heterosexual, so straight men. So 90 to 98%. So even if we looked at it at the 90%, that's 10% within that whole thing, maybe identifying with any other orientation. And there are so many others that aren't just straight or gay exclusively. So I think that, you know, we see that, again, we have to look at how do we extract this aspect of adult orientation versus attraction to younger children, and how those aren't the same thing at all. You know, when we see a man sexually assaulting a young girl, we don't label him straight, right? We label him a child molester. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make any sense to say if we see a man molesting and sexually abusing a young boy that we then say gay. You know, we should say child molester, sexual abuse. So linking those two things really doesn't make sense, and it's only been done that way, I think, because of this legacy, like Michael was saying, this cultural baggage of, you know, that gay men are intrinsically more attracted to younger people. And we've seen this go through the Boy Scouts, through, you know, lots of religious organizations trying to kind of weed out this potential threat when the threat is always there, because the threat is not about adult orientation, the threat is about attraction to children.
Kevin Coffey?
Pedophilia is a primary sexual attraction, and it's not gay. They are attracted to children, and there's research into that. And actually, there's been quite a bit of research done on gay parenting, and the research has shown that kids are just as healthy who grew up in gay parented households to straight parenting households.
Let me just read a little bit of what the American Psychological Association has said. They say children are not more likely to be molested by LGBT parents or their LGBT friends or acquaintances. Gregory Herrick, a professor at the University of California, Davis, who's one of the nation's leading researchers on prejudice against sexual minorities, reviewed a series of studies and found no evidence that gay men molest children at higher rates than heterosexual men. And to Rowan's point, Herrick tried to take a look at, kind of did a meta study, take a look at a lot of studies because a lot of them are sort of asked and answered years ago. Mm-hmm. But here we are. Take our first phone call. This is Richard in Kendall. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I just was feeling that Kevin Spacey's comment, while I can understand how the gay community might feel as if it was exacerbating or perhaps creating a situation where people who are already homophobic, for instance, would feel as if this was giving or perhaps creating more evidence. But I really feel like people's attitudes about the gay community, lesbian community, are pretty much already set. Maybe people who are sitting on the fence, you know, who may feel that this sort of sways them one way or the other, but I'm not sure that that attitudes, particularly about this issue, are going to be changed very much one way or the other.
Richard, let me just kind of ask you to stay with us for a second and just point out again that you know, we have seen remarkable change in public polling. And again, maybe not to the level that it probably ought to be, given everything that we understand about human nature, but remarkable changes in one and two generations' time in this country, not just with marriage equality, but that has been a huge change in terms of the numbers of public support, et cetera, but in all of these issues. I mean, I'm with you that a lot of people don't change their minds on a lot of different things. But when you look at 1977 and a Gallup poll finding that only 27% of Americans think gay people should be allowed to teach elementary school children, and that number doubles in a generation's time, again, it should be higher, but it doubles in a generation's time, it's probably significantly higher than that today, maybe not to the 90% range, but it's much higher today. Isn't that a sign that people do change over time with more education and more outreach?
Yeah, I think so. I might be speaking more in terms of my own generation. I'm in my late 60s, mm-hmm. and my circle of friends, I think, are probably, and relatives are more in my age, and I'm probably reflecting attitudes that perhaps are more prevalent in my age group. I mean, I understand, I agree with you that attitudes have changed. I'm a little bit skeptical as to whether those attitudes have changed, I think, in my age group. People who are older.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. I mean, I you know, I can only speak as a parent of a 5-year-old who, you know, last year in his class, two of his friends had two moms. That is just not a thing. It was just not. I mean, it was not even a It was nothing. Yeah. And you know, I think every subsequent generation is probably a little bit more inclusive, though I think it's a little bit of a risk to assume that will always be the case. I mean, I think progress probably requires effort, but I think the idea toward inclusion is fair. So I'm with you there, Richard. I mean, maybe there are generational divides, and let me ask all of our guests. I'll start with Rowan. What you think of Richard's comments here?
No, I think I agree, and thank you very much, Richard, for calling in and those thoughts. That it can feel often as though, you know, the more time that we've had on Earth in society, the more firm we may think our beliefs are because we've had longer to sit with them and know them to be true or not have them challenged. You know, younger children are mostly blank canvases. They're waiting to see what the world is like for them. And the longer we live, the more, you know, set we feel oftentimes. But I really do think that there are so many ways that folks can be, you know, touched by the heart and minds and hearing people's stories and just seeing the kind of the amazing shift in some public perception just around the transgender community in the last couple of years. I mean, in like 3 years, we've done decades worth of work by connecting folks through stories. And so sometimes that kind of the danger of sub-public figures is that we feel like we know them, right? Like people have seen Kevin Spacey's movies and his media in theater for decades, and people will feel like they had a good idea of him at least. And so we can often feel as though this is a personal story for us. And so our perception can sometimes be changed, even by technically a stranger. Just that one story can sometimes really kind of get under our skin or become kind of part of our understanding of the cultural framework.
Hmm. Michael, do you agree that generationally there's change that we tend to see?
I think we're seeing change generationally, but I think we can also see that shift quickly. We've seen that historically where progress has been undercut by the rise of another political party. But I also think there's a difference in what we're talking about, where marriage equality, and I think the numbers show it, the difference of people who accept marriage equality versus those who'd want an LGBTQ person teaching their children. And there's where, like, the logic doesn't match up, because people probably logically know that their children will not be molested or, sexually assaulted by an LGBTQ person, but there's that fear within them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a conscious fear. I think that's somewhere back in their head that they're not truly aware of. And that's probably the difference between the numbers.
Hmm, interesting. And do you also agree that there is a risk to thinking that progress will always be sort of a straight line?
Yeah, that's the risk of the progress narrative. There's this idea that everything's always getting better, and we can see, you know, year to year how things do shift. We may move forward with LGBTQ rights 1 year, and then we'll shift back with women's rights, or obviously we've seen with Black Lives Matter, like really highlighting how we haven't moved far in other issues.
Kevin, how do you feel about the difference in generations' views of these kinds of issues?
I think young people are less and less, it's less and less an issue for. And I think sometimes I've seen in older people, like they, as they get up there, they begin to think about that something's just not that important. And so I've seen people soften in their opinions, older folks too.
Interesting. I always find that beautiful in those moments. I think there's something really nice to see that, because I think Richard is a little bit more pessimistic that people in his age cohort can change.
And yeah, I've seen older folks who really, you know, it's like all of a sudden things are just not an issue. And I think that's, you see life as it's supposed to be.
Well, again, listeners, if you want to join the program, we're going to spend part of our second half hour talking about how we continue to move the public understanding and the public views of these related issues. And I think it starts with our kids, but not just assuming, that progress continues to go in any certain direction. And the question is, what kind of work does it require? What have you seen in your own kids or maybe in your own relationships? It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Joel writes to us and says, was there a story in the last few weeks about a transgender person assaulting someone that similar issues are rising up, that people want to latch onto this to say, hey, we have to worry about trans people. Is there a risk that the progress in the trans community could be undercut in that way? Rowan.
That's a good question. I think that unfortunate link has already been established. It's not a recent thing. That misconception of trans folks being, again, the same sort of like sexual predator or going to behave in some inappropriate way in a public setting is often what is undercutting, is kind of behind a lot of the legislation we see around bathroom usage facilities and public spaces across the country. So starting, about 2 years ago with the HB2 in North Carolina, a lot of that is, again, much like Michael has been touching on, that kind of really intrinsic reptilian brain fear of something is going to happen to me or someone that I love. My child, my loved one, my friend, something is going to happen to them if they are just in the same space alone with this person or this image of this person that I have in my head. So I think that that is absolutely true, that we do see those misconceptions, those deeply held myths and stereotypes about the trans community, obviously different, but very much in the same vein of the kind that we see that direct linkage with the gay male population as well.
Rowan, is the trans community more vulnerable to these kind of stereotypes reemerging because the progress that you see in the last 12 to 36 months that feels like decades worth of work is so new? In other words, you know, if you've seen attitudes and understandings change about the trans community in just the last couple of years, because it's sort of a fresh issue for people, is it more at risk of being undercut by these negative stories if they appear?
I think so. It's kind of like just as fast as it can be built, it can be taken right back down. You know, if folks can feel this way within 12 to 36 months, then I really think that lots of these things are incredibly vulnerable. The main thing is that lots of the kind of advancements that have been made are not set in stone when it comes to law. You know, we have executive orders from a governor, or we have policies from one organization, and that's doing the great kind of piecemeal work, but we don't have statewide protection in most of the states in this country for employment discrimination or public accommodation or even housing for trans individuals, let alone anything on the federal level. You know, we see policies being rescinded by the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, left and right. And so the kind of the really quick acceleration was mostly around some societal views, but a lot of what needed to be done in terms of policy just hasn't been done yet, and there's almost like no way to get it done fast enough. And I think that we do see this kind of amazing kind of backlash happening. Where it stands right now, we are there have been, I want to say 26 trans individuals murdered this year alone that we know of, and it is by far the deadliest on record. And we said that last year and the year before that. And I would be remiss to not point out that the vast majority of the individuals who have been murdered this year on that list are transgender women of color, specifically Black transgender women. So we're seeing such an intersection of issues here, but there is a body count associated with the backlash around specifically the trans community, but these things are happening to folks throughout the LGBT community. We're seeing a rise in bias incidences against gay men, against lesbian-identified women, against bisexual folks, anyone in the gender-expansive community. So I think that just as fast as it comes up, it comes right back down as well.
Michael Lecker, thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, I think the rhetoric really does impact people's lives. These just aren't words. These words lead to people acting out, because as horrifying as it is, these biases and these fears are, people feel them like intrinsically and they react on them because they for some reason do think that LGBTQ people are a threat to their family. And so I think the all the education and working against that is needed. But I think the thing that scares me is that they see this as a legitimate threat, like the bathroom bills especially.
Kevin, why is it that we allow fears so much to dominate our perceptions? I mean, some fears are just irrational. It's just this morning, and I would urge listeners to check out the Twitter feed of Tom Nichols, one of my favorite Twitter followers, who wrote a book called The Death of Expertise. He's a conservative, works for the Naval College, but he has been railing against fellow conservatives today who are urging everyone to take guns into church. And he says, churches are one of the safest places you can be. And they said, well, look at Texas. And he said, well, look at every other church that's ever existed in this country. And he said, you know, we're just not good at handling fear. And we let irrational views of single incidents lead to not only our own behavior, but our calls for policy change sometimes. And okay, you can understand the emotion that comes, especially if you know someone who has been victimized. But looking from afar at incidents, whether it's that terrible mass shooting in Texas this weekend or really anything else, we tend to let fear kind of overrun our ability to process information. Is that just how we are wired? Is there a way to get
actually
past
it? Is how we're wired.
It is?
Because there are about 10 changes in the body when we're afraid, and one of them is the frontal lobe of the brain shuts off, because you only need there are very few choices when you're afraid. It's either escape or fight. And so that part of your brain is gone. And so that is where we do our highest level of thinking. And people, when they're afraid, don't do their best thinking.
But can we, maybe you're afraid at a moment or reading a news headline or a story creates some fear in you, but can't we then sort of diffuse that a little bit, especially if we know that fear is a potentially dominating force? Is there a way for us to sort of grapple with how we deal with that?
I think there are ways, but I think unfortunately when people get into that mode, they don't know it sometimes that they're in that mode, and they think that it's okay. I mean, I thought it was odd that someone in the church had a gun. like yesterday, President Trump was talking this morning about, you know, thank goodness there was somebody there with a gun who could fight back. And I'm thinking, like, in church, he had a gun? That makes no sense. So there is, when people are in this emotional mind of fear, they don't think. And you have to know you're there to be able to do some things to get yourself out of it.
Well, after our only break of the hour, we're going to take some more of your feedback. Jane, we'll take your phone call as well. We've got some emails to read, the thoughts that have come in. If you want to join the conversation, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Kevin Spacey's comments last week, in which he responded to actor Anthony Rapp's allegation that Spacey sexually assaulted him when he was 14 years old. Spacey's comments, in which he also came out as a gay man, has led to some troubling links, or at least a feeling in some parts of the gay community that here we go again, because the research has never borne that out, and these stereotypes have been hard to erase completely. So we're talking about education, talking about fear, we're talking about reality, and a lot more with our guests in studio this hour. You just heard Kevin Confey, assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center, Michael Lecker, director of LGBTQ health and inclusiveness at Trillium Health, and Rowan Collins, education and communications coordinator for the LGBTQ Academy at the Out Alliance. More of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester native Todd Moss is back in studio with us. He's in Rochester today as a guest of the Jewish Book Festival. His new book is called The Shadow List, the fourth thriller in his series starring Judd and Jessica Riker. Now, it's fiction, but a lot of it feels like reality, and Todd should know he was the former assistant deputy secretary of state under the Bush administration. He's my guest next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jane in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan. I'm a little confused about the whole thing with Kevin Spacey and what the hoopla is about. Is it that people fear that if you're gay, you're also a pedophile? Is that what's going on? Just answer that, and then I'll continue.
Yes. I mean,
okay, that's the crux of it. Oh, you're gay, therefore you're dangerous?
Oh, yeah. That was a stereotype that goes back decades in this country and hasn't been entirely eradicated,
well,
yes.
The only one that I heard many, many years ago from a social worker teacher I had, of all things, but she was saying, oh, no, they recruit. And I thought, coming from her, she was such an evolved person, I just thought, I really had to think about that. I don't quite know what that means. But as far as pedophilia goes, and I can't prove this with statistics, but I would fear the family itself. It's nearly always, we've been told, a very trusted adult, not a stranger, a trusted adult, an uncle, a father, that commits pedophile, period, no matter male, female, whatever. But don't you think, and to some extent, it stays in the media, we've had such a terrible time with discovering that priests and coaches and Boy Scout leaders and teachers, you know, that we never would have expected. But it does go back to that idea that it's nearly always a very trusted person you would never, ever suspect. And we've been so disappointed, and it keeps it going on. But I don't know. I don't believe that your sexual orientation has anything to do with pedophilia.
Yeah,
but
it
wanted to clear that up. And we're talking about the crime of pedophilia, and your sexual orientation just belongs to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. That's right. In fact, just to kind of close the loop on that, Jane's question, kind of just making sure she understands the concern. Yeah, there's been that stereotype that not just Americans, a lot of people have had about gay people for years, that's not true. So when Kevin Spacey says, hey, I am really sorry to Anthony Rapp if I did that 30 years ago. You know, it was deeply inappropriate. It would have been drunken behavior. And by the way, I'm a gay man. He might as well have said, by the way, I like turtles. Oh, okay. Not really related here, Kevin. I don't. And why are we doing this in one statement? Again, maybe I'm with Michael Lecker in saying I don't know that Kevin Spacey was really a sort of nefariously trying to link these things, probably more just provide himself a little bit of headline cover. But it's too bad. But to Jane's point is, and I'll turn to Kevin Coffey on this one. Her suspicion is that when pedophilia happens, it's probably someone very close to you. It's probably not randomized. I mean, do we know that is that the case?
That's true. Statistics would say. I was just teaching policy this weekend. More often than not, abuse happens right in the family. It's one of the parents or a close relative. And it is very seldom a random individual.
She also said that she had known a social worker, Rowan, who, kind of shocked her with that comment that she thought gay people might recruit. So, I mean, is that part of the stereotypical lore, the agenda?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the most pervasive and well-known kind of myths about specifically gay men, but the kind of the community at large. And it's troublesome, but not that unexpected to know that even folks in social work and social services have held those and continue to hold those sorts of beliefs. I mean, we actually see that there's not actually a lot of time devoted to LGBTQ plus issues and identities within curriculum for pretty much anybody. I mean, we're talking nurses, doctors, social workers, mental health professionals. It's just not on the docket. And so, all it takes sometimes is that one professor who you trust and know to be, really on board and a really progressive individual to say, well, they might also do this, and then we have a whole class, if not a whole generation, of folks assuming that this must be true. This trusted individual, this professional, said that this was something that they do.
Ooh, Michael?
Yeah. Well, I think in the 1970s we saw this rhetoric pop up, and it's because ethnic and racial minorities grow because they reproduce. LGBTQ people, largely because of the sex that we have, do not reproduce through typical means. And so I think there's this idea of, well, how does this group expand? And so the fear takes over, and they're like, well, they must recruit. They must be out there trying to target our children to bring them into their, perverted lifestyles. And that was the rhetoric of the 70s. And as sometimes our professors get taught in the 1970s and don't get refreshed.
And I guess I shouldn't be surprised, because there's a not statistically insignificant part of the population that thinks that sexual orientation is a choice. So if it's a lifestyle, if it's choice, why wouldn't you be recruiting? Because why not increase
give other
the
people
rank?
That choice.
So we should probably just say that, I'm pretty sure if I had to list like the gay agenda, it would be like love people, don't discriminate, live in a world where you don't get discriminated at work. Pretty much it. I don't know. I could
buy
say
milk.
Buy milk. I could say stereotypically throw great parties, but not all gay people are throw great parties. A lot of them do. I just don't understand why we're still here with this, but we are. So again, if you want to weigh in on that, what I want to do is we'll take a few more of your comments on these issues. I want to read an email. It comes from a listener that says the following. Looking historically at relationship development, particularly in gay men attracted to men, there was often no way for us to understand, to learn the basic rules of relationships, such as falling in love, dating, heartbreak, falling out of love, moving on, etc. Most people learn these life lessons in their teens, often in junior high and high school. I spent most of my public school years avoiding intimate and dating relationships outside of platonic friendships. I remember being confronted by a classmate who was my girlfriend, asking me why I didn't try to kiss her. We were great platonic friends, still are, 40 years later, but I couldn't answer her. I knew the truth, but was disgusted by the truth of my attractions. I am lucky that once I did accept my sexual orientation at 20 years old, I quickly became an activist and went through dating puberty in my early 20s with healthy role models around me. This is not to excuse or defend Kevin Spacey, but to put some perspective on us gay men of a certain age. The best thing I have seen in recent years is that young gay men can now practice dating in their youth and develop relationship skills alongside their peers. Let me get some response from our panel on that. I'll start with Rowan. What do you think?
Sure. I think that absolutely holds true, that, we through generations have been taught that your identity, your orientation, that there's a shameful aspect of that, and that's something to be kept to yourself, partially through all of these negative stereotypes. Why would you want that associated with you? Your parents wouldn't want that for you. You don't want that for yourself. And folks do. they hide that through all means necessary, whether it is kind of overcompensating in the other direction or kind of just avoiding intimate relationships in general, which can really stunt folks in their emotional development and their growth as a human. And I absolutely think that we've seen a trend changing that folks are coming out and as their authentic selves when they first discover it. And they're not bottling it up for decades and decades. And that has, I think, seen a shift in the way that folks are creating relationships and interacting with each other in a much more healthy way that has allowed for, better health, just understanding their own sexuality in a way that is developmentally appropriate.
Kevin, when it comes to the way this could impact us, you know, just mentally, psychologically, relationship development, I think of my own high school graduation. 304 students graduated from my high school the year I graduated. I mean, I knew one out gay woman and maybe one out gay man. Now, at high school reunions, there's 25 gay couples that come from that class. I mean, maybe 30. It's great. You know, some I didn't know, some sort of suspected. But even in my time from high school graduation to today, that change is significant because when I went to prom, I don't recall a lot of gay couples at prom. And I talk to parents now of kids who are in high school, and they're like, yeah, there's gay couples at prom all the time. It's awesome. You know, I mean, it's really welcoming. There's a feeling of... So I read this email, and I think of developing your sort of your skills at understanding dating and relationships and having to suppress that during the years when middle school, high school, when straight kids are doing it out and publicly. What is the impact on human beings who have to try to bottle that up and then find a way later in life to deal with that? Again, I agree with email, not to suggest this has anything to do with pedophilia or Kevin Spacey. This is an entirely separate question. But what's the impact there?
I agree with the person who wrote the email very much, because I think then what happens is people are forced to do things in secret, or a lot of the behavior. I mean, it was interesting. I was talking with Scott at the Gay Alliance last week, and even the numbers of gay bars in this community have decreased since the 1980s, because that was the only place that people could go and be themselves. And now I think one of the people I supervise, her son went to the prom at Brighton High School with another guy. And, there's nobody bats an eye. And I think that's really, in terms of self-esteem and self-acceptance, those things are, which are really part of identity and healthy living, that is really a much better world to live in. And then I graduated a long time ago in 1975 from high school, and the world was really different.
Thoughts on that, Michael Lecker?
Yeah, I just want to caution us to not just put a blanket, this blanket of progress over the U.S. because, geography matters here. And so inside Rochester, this may be happening. But I think we're going to be dealing with these issues for decades and decades to come, because not all LGBTQ kids are going through this. We're seeing still tremendous amounts of suicide, harassment, bullying, and homicide. And so I think that I just want to caution us not to be like, it's all getting better for everybody.
Or it's easy to be a gay teenager.
Yeah.
Right.
Because, I mean, we still have this predominant heterosexist narrative of like, I'm going to find a wife, I'm going to have children, I'm going to grow up and get married, and this is my life. And I think once we hopefully will get to the point where a young person won't realize that they have same-sex desire, and that will cause them to think that their life will then be tragically different or dramatically different. But I don't think we're there yet. I think we're caught up on this one difference within me is a major difference. I live for the world where it will be a minor difference in whatever sexuality you are or whatever gender expression you have that is glossed over and not thought of anything else. It would be thought of like, oh, they just happen to like turtles.
I like the liking turtles. Now, that is, I think, really wise. And I want to ask Rowan, I want to follow up Rowan on this, because some of Rowan's work is working with schools, right? You know, you work with districts in different places about... just working with students, understanding what inclusion is. Mm-hmm. And you have talked about working with districts in very different geographic settings, mm-hmm. and then so finding exactly what Michael's talking about. So can you kind of follow up there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Michael's absolutely correct, and I appreciate that kind of that caveat. That yeah, you know, the same thing. Progress takes effort, and the second anyone is complacent, it is snatched right back very often. And so yeah, we've worked with almost all of the public school districts in Monroe County, and then some are in our surrounding counties as well. And that's a lot of districts in our area in very different environments. I mean, we're looking at urban, suburban, rural. Urban in different places. So I've been surprised in either direction everywhere that I've gone. Places where I assumed, it was going to be a tougher conversation to have, it was so easy. In places where I assumed, well, there must be things in place already, there was nothing. Or places that I've been like, they've been doing so well for years and someone's dropped the ball or there's been a shift somewhere and things really aren't where they need to be anymore. So there's, I think, absolutely, even in our, our bubble in the Rochester area, which, we're fortunate to be where we are here, because in other spots in our country, it's far worse, but there's always more to be done, especially with our younger folks.
Rowan, I want to go back to the phone call from Richard, who was talking about generational differences, and ask you, and again, this is going to be sort of a generalization, and I always want to be careful with this, especially because you just pointed out, well, you can make assumptions about what you're going to find in a district, and sometimes in either direction, it could surprise you. But if there is a stereotype that the more rural you get, the less equipped the schools are going to be to sort of handle or work with these issues, is that the case for adults, for administrators? But are students, for our 14, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 16, 17-year-olds, everywhere you go a little bit more inclusive? I mean, is that also true? I mean, I'm careful not to generalize here, but I'm curious to know if you see what you're seeing.
That's the great question. I would absolutely never put that kind of generalization on anyone based on their geographical location. I mean, so much of the stuff that we do is around kind of what resources folks even have. I mean, if we're looking at, a school that doesn't even have the funding to help students who have, any sort of different developmental needs or learning, and they don't have the means to address folks who are living in extreme poverty. I mean, there's all sorts of things that need to be in place in order for folks to properly address and accommodate students with, who are walking in as something outside of what's expected of them. But I absolutely think that the trend I see is that definitely some of our younger generations are much more open and inclusive. The vast majority of the work I do is with teachers and administrators, usually the adults, and they're kind of saying, I'm really glad that you came in and did our training for us and not just for our students, because, the students don't need it as much as we do, because they're living in a world where things are moving forward. There's always progress to be made, but there's a much more of an open conversation. There's kids of all different beliefs and opinions on things like this. And, it would, again, be dangerous to assume that, all young people are totally okay with everything and they're open and everyone's great. But there does seem to be an overwhelming majority in a way that there hasn't been in previous generations.
All right, let's get ready to close the program with the reminder that the research that has been done for years indicates that when it comes to preying on children and the allegations that are made against Kevin Spacey in particular, that's not related to whether he's gay or not. That's not related to that. And the research bears that out, that there are child predators in every cohort of our population, and they do not really vary based on sexual orientation. They just don't. And so let's get rid of that. And if you ever hear anybody raise it, just know that the research doesn't support it, and you can tell them that. That's probably a good thing. 30 seconds, just real briefly, Michael Lecker, some final thoughts from you as we get ready to, what do you want to leave the audience with here?
Yeah, I think, if we want to live in a better world and be the progressive people that we are, we need to practice at it. So we need to go to trainings like the Ad Alliance does and that Trillium Health does. We need to practice this. And so when we're confronted with it in our lives, we can enact that instead of going back to that fear.
Okay. Rowan?
I absolutely have to agree with Michael that it's that practice, it's the work of the progress that, when we need to make sure we're not just hearing one story and saying that must be true. It confirms my bias that I already had. What else is out there? Where am I hearing this from? What does this mean? And what resources are in my area? We're incredibly fortunate to be in the Rochester area where we can have these sorts of conversations constantly. Encouraging folks to pick up the phone and give the organizations in the area a call and say, hey, I'm struggling with this thought, or I've heard this story. What do we know? We get calls all the time about that, and we would really encourage folks to take advantage of the resources in our area, especially when it comes to the LGBTQ+ community.
And quick thoughts, Kevin Coffey.
education really helps people overcome fears, and that's what probably is the bottom line, is the more education people can have about this issue and other issues like racism, mm-hmm. and then the better off we are.
That's great. Kevin Coffey is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thanks for being here this hour, Kevin.
Thank you.
Rowan Collins, Education and Communications Coordinator for the LGBTQ Academy at the Out Alliance. Contact them where?
OutAlliance.org. Find us on Facebook at Out Alliance Rock.
Out Alliance Rock and OutAlliance.org. Michael Lecker, Director of LGBTQ Health and Inclusiveness at Trillium Health. Find you where?
M. Lecker at TrilliumHealth.org.
TrilliumHealth.org. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Much more connections coming up. Sure.